You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So Glenn Otis Brown is currently the director of business development at Twitter. Before that, he worked on partnerships for music at YouTube, has been involved in the Berkman community for many, many years, was the first executive director of Creative Commons?
Technically the second.
Executive director of Creative Commons. Among a list of other great accomplishments, his bio is on the web, and he can tell you more about himself as well. So welcome, Glenn.
Thanks a lot for having me. I was a Berkman intern, about 13 years ago. And back when the Berkman Center was a hallway, literally a hallway in Pound Hall. You all know the lore. But I was just really, really happy to be here. And I can say that among a lot of the people that I worked with then who were students here when the Berkman Center was just starting, our careers have all been just like a straight line, straight out of the Berkman Center. Like everything we've done has been thanks to the Berkman Center as kind of the but for cause, as a lawyer would say. So it's really, really cool to be back here and see such a big group, and to see what the Berkman Center's become, just a total juggernaut in this area. So I am not going to talk much about Twitter. I'm not going to really talk about Twitter in kind of any kind of official capacity, so I just want to get that point out in front. There's topics in here that might touch on Twitter, and there'll be things that I talk about from my experience at YouTube and Creative Commons. But I really wanted just to kind of present a couple of ideas that are really just kind of sketches. They started really as almost free associations, and that I don't really have a lot of answers to give you in a lot of this. I basically just kind of want to present a couple of frameworks and figure out what this crowd can do with it and what, you know, maybe going forward, what scholars or different companies and things like that can do with them. The two topics are, one is I'm calling Top Secret All Rights Reserved XXX. And the second one I'm calling Bots, Mobs, and Geeks. And I want to start with the Top Secret All Rights Reserved XXX because I hope it will actually build on the Hyperpublic conference that just happened recently. And I didn't get to attend, but I kind of attended via Twitter and got a lot of thoughts going. And I'm hoping there's some good intersection there. So I want to start with that. So just to start off, speaking of kind of free associations, when the first when WikiLeaks kind of first hit the news as a big news event, I had this kind of almost visual kind of free association with a memory of being an intern in the State Department, and documents were stamped with this kind of hierarchy of confidentiality. And you literally would have a stamp at your desk and stamp it. I didn't have a top secret stamp. I didn't have an eyes only stamp because I was an intern. But this is basically just kind of the hierarchy and familiar things from the movies or anybody who's worked in government. They're just kind of familiar things. And when the WikiLeaks thing came around, this was the kind of visual free association I had, having worked at Creative Commons years later, that there was this kind of weird similarity in this kind of hierarchy of gradations of control in totally different areas. But that looked amazingly kind of similar in some ways. And, you know, we even at Creative Commons would use the metaphor of stamping your works with Creative Commons licenses. And then it made me, you know, led me thinking back to kind of teenage years and sneaking into movies you weren't supposed to be sneaking into, and the similar kind of gradation of control there. And then it also got me thinking about privacy settings. This is a screenshot of my Facebook privacy settings, but it applies in a number of other contexts, a number of other sites. And it got me thinking, what, if anything, can we conclude from all this? They're all very different kind of regimes. You know, you've got basically kind of hierarchy of confidentiality enforced by the government. You've got a hierarchy of kind of copyright controls enforced by a combination of the government in the default copyright rules and just this voluntary group of people using Creative Commons licenses. You've got this kind of self-regulatory regime that the MPAA created, and you've got these privacy settings that users, you know, to a certain extent, based on the kind of default policies privacy policies of websites control. And so there's a lot of different ways we could go. We could talk about this. I just want to touch on one really briefly and then dig more deeply into the privacy piece of it. So one is, you know, you've probably seen some scholarship and some journalism and a lot of discussion around kind of what I think primarily the trigger being WikiLeaks, kind of what lessons could be learned from copyright in the WikiLeaks setting and how they weren't necessarily applicable. One topic that's been written a lot about in legal scholarship is basically the idea of when can, in what settings is it appropriate for the government to restrain speech or restrain publication. And there's this odd, possibly disconnect, in some people's minds it's a disconnect, in some people's minds it's actually consistent, of you have a case like the Pentagon Papers where an injunction was ruled a prior restraint of the publication of a newspaper. You're talking about the publication of a piece of news, and the Supreme Court ruled that was a prior restraint of speech. Then in the copyright context, you have injunctions handed out all the time for pre-publication of works that are found to be infringing. One kind of famous case was a parody of Gone with the Wind called The Wind Done Gone that was actually around 2000 that was there was the publication of it was actually prevented by an injunction by the court, later overruled, but there is a lot kind of written about this in particular in legal scholarship and this kind of strange thing where, you know, the entire secret plan of the Vietnam War could not be withheld from being published, but a parody of a novel or take your pick in a number of other copyright contexts could. There's not, I think I remember from the introduction, not a ton of lawyers in the room, right? There's only like one or two, I think. So none, just me, really? That's awesome. Okay, a couple, even better. That's great, yeah, I'm gonna make it all up now. So this is a concept that, you know, in the context of copyright gets talked about a lot in, I think both economists and lawyers talk about this, the difference between property rules and liability rules. Property rules are rules where you basically have to ask permission of the property holder and negotiate and bargain on a one-by-one basis. And liability rules are rules where you can basically, as a licensee or as a user, use a work as long as you pay some fair amount. The copyright holder can't tell you no. Best example of this in copyright is covering a song. This is a great old rule in music law that basically you can cover someone else's song as long as you pay a statutory rate set by the government to whoever owns the copyright of the song. It's kind of a weird rule. If you think about that, how that would apply across other parts of the creative economy, you can't do that with sampling. You can't do that with using other people's photos. If you know Terry Fisher's book, Promises to Keep, he basically proposes that all kind of the entertainment industry should work on liability rule or liability kind of rule regime, basically let everything flow and just set some fair rates for everybody. The thing that's interesting about that when you try and apply it to the government context is there's no real analog to that. That's not a potential remedy for the kind of confidential government information scenario. So just wanted to touch on that one for a second. And there's lots to look up on that. And if you're interested in that topic, there's definitely a lot of scholarship on that. Like I said, there's a lot of different ways we can talk about lessons to apply from one context to another, but I wanted to focus on this one, on what basically we can think of to apply from the kind of the Creative Commons world or the customization of copyright into the privacy world and the customization of your private data or your private information. And I want to take it not too literally in terms of not just literally just take what the Creative Commons model is and port it over to privacy, but actually want to think about it from the point of view of a user of, say, a social network who is not a Berkman Center person, who's not a lawyer, who's not who doesn't work in Silicon Valley, and think about it from their point of view in terms of how they come to expect their information to be treated on a site. And if you think about kind of when people are, I think the best example of it is when people post family pictures online, their anxiety about what is done with that picture is often not, doesn't take the form of a copyright anxiety. People don't think in terms of like, I, you know, don't want people to copy this. I don't want them to commercialize it. It takes more of the kind of anxiety, the form of something kind of privacy flavored, or it's more about context and it's more about reputational rights and things like that. And what is, you know, what gets associated with this image. And I think from the point of view of a user, say, on any social network, the privacy settings can be basically, if you think back on that kind of the Facebook matrix of privacy settings, those are almost just like copyright permissions. They're essentially saying, who can see my work and under what circumstances, and what circles of people can see my work, and it's a lot like Creative Commons that way. Here's another example from a few years back in Creative Commons where Virgin in Australia had this series of billboard posters around that you were using Flickr images that were Creative Commons licensed, and there was this, there was an outrage because of the way people got contextualized in this. From a copyright point of view, Virgin was free and clear. They were using a Creative Commons attribution license, although they didn't actually provide attribution here, I don't think. But a small footnote. But what caused the kind of outrage among the people who just found themselves in billboards all across Australia was that they were kind of made to look like fools in a lot of these ads. And it got to the point of people trying to stop the publication of these billboards on the theory that they hadn't signed model releases. So again, that's sort of different anxiety than a copyright anxiety. So I mentioned before that I feel like a lot of what was discussed in Hyperpublic could be really applicable here. And again, rather than thinking about just taking the Creative Commons model and pasting it onto privacy, how can we? Is it possible to think of a way to kind of unify the two in terms of my personal information, my expression, in terms of copyright or privacy? And is there a way to think of some way of unifying how we can govern those as kind of citizens? You can think about it from purely a self-help point of view, or we can think about it from a public policy point of view, like how could the law change? It's a much bigger conversation. I think it might be more interesting to look at it from a self-help point of view. There's definitely precedents for this. I mean, this is a paper that Jonathan Zittrain wrote in the early Berkman Center days, what the publisher can teach the patient, which was applying kind of lessons from the music industry in Napster, this was 1999, to medical data privacy, and basically seeing if there were things like some kind of DRM that could be used for personal privacy, or maybe some kind of machine-readable markup language that could be used to help people control their own private information. There's other precedents, Mozilla has played with the idea of having kind of privacy icons that'll show up and tell you basically the privacy policy of the site automatically. There's other precedents that are older, like in a way, PGP is kind of a self-help mechanism for privacy. P3P is sort of a machine-readable early effort at doing this with privacy. But I just wanted to kind of open it up and see what all, particularly given the Hyperpublic conversation, what all we could talk about here in terms of what are different ways that users could try and merge these two, or does it make sense even to kind of merge these two? And from the point of view of, I think particularly from the point of view of interacting with big platforms like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, is this a place that would be interesting to discuss? I wanted to open it up just to talk about this now and let other people come up with things, because I, just looking through kind of what's been done before with these precedents, I imagine that I really only know the tip of the iceberg in terms of what people have been thinking here. So that's where I want to just pause and open it up. Yeah.
So I'm from Vancouver, home of the Vancouver Nuts. What happened in Boston Bruins last week, they also know what happened in the last week of the riot. And something that's going on, and there's quite an uproar around it, is that a lot of the people that were involved in the vandalism, I'm sure people saw the pictures and videos, were doing a lot of posing for photos, active posing. They saw that they could clearly see that everybody around them had a cell phone. Every photo you see people up with their arms up, rather taking photos. A lot of people were getting tagged. A lot of the premier of the province, which is the equivalent of the governor, is basically calling for basically public, some people are calling it public vigilantism, to turn people in. And I'm just wondering people's thoughts, because, you know, there's a lot of discussion amongst my friends on Facebook, and a little bit torn, because I think this is not surveillance when people were doing things in public, destroying public and private property, and in full view of cameras, and sometimes even inviting it and posing for it.
Right.
So just curious to hear thoughts on the line between public and private.
So sort of this was crowdsourced surveillance in a way, right?
is it crowdsourced and is it surveillance when it takes the form of social media?
Right, right.
Would it be any different if it was more traditional media? If they were using photos that were taken by professional photographers in the traditional media sense than just other members of the crowd?
Right, and people saying, call this number and identify these people, America's Most Wanted style, right? Right, and would that be different?
I was not aware of the Ukraine paper you referenced, but I'm not aware of anybody doing anything like this in health records. There is a mishmash of state laws that try to subdivide, for instance, HIV, how HIV information in a health record has to be treated differently from psychiatric information in a health record. But the question I would have is, how does one get something like this out into the internet,
mm-hmm.
if you wanted to do it within the domain of, say, health records or anything else?
Mm-hmm.
What's the distribution mechanism?
What's the distribution mechanism for this kind of, if there's some sort of self-help, if there's some sort of way of encoding your private data?
Whatever.
It's a really good question. I actually brought it up just as open of a discussion point as this at a Creative Commons board meeting. Like, what if we did get into privacy? What if we did kind of merge these topics and think about it from the point of view of the non-geek users, I put it before. And, you know, that was one of the questions that came up, like, how in the world would we establish that standard? And then we, you know, some people in the room kind of looked around and said, well, we did that with Creative Commons. It was totally grassroots. And we did kind of establish a standard that is now respected by the terms of service of big platforms like Flickr and now recently YouTube. So it's one of those chicken and egg things, like maybe it could come from the top down. Maybe it's just one of those things that if there's a groundswell of people who agree on a common language for this kind of thing, then maybe the platforms would have to respect that common language. I don't know. It's a really big question. So, yeah.
So I was thinking of a case a number of years ago in which a young woman, I think this might have been pre-Facebook, had a lot of photos she shared with her friends and family, and she died, and the family put up a memorial, including a picture of her at the beach in a bikini. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if some other site, knowing that she was dead or not, I don't recall, like, made her the bikini babe of the week or something like that. And the family objected, because this was a memorial and not something to be, you know, leered at. And so that speaks to the issue of context, and I think different from some of the things like Creative Commons or P3P, context is so nuanced and subjective and human. In fact, there's a scholar named Helen Nissenbaum who has this whole idea of contextual privacy. And so I think it's interesting to think about, but I am kind of skeptical, though I'd love to see something like it, just because how are you going to cross the subjectivities of different people, particularly, I mean, the internet's a global phenomenon, so there's macro-cultural differences. Seems just like a very challenging problem.
Yeah, and I totally agree. The context is a big challenge to it, and then also privacy. One big distinction between, say, copyright and privacy from just a purely legal point of view is copyright, you have default rules that are universal. Mm-hmm. Privacy, you have this weird mishmash of state, federal, international laws, and every website has completely different practices, right? Like their server logs do different things, and so I know I agree that that's the so one's the kind of more harder technical challenge. Another one's kind of the softer qualitative point about context. I totally agree. I think even with Creative Commons, it comes up all the time, the contextual points. I think there's Virgin Australia example kind of illustrates. So I think that's a tough one.
Well, to touch upon what you just said, I think one of the difficulties when, you know, you're comparing copyright and privacy is that copyright tends to be, at least legally, mostly a tort issue. Whereas with privacy, yes, there's like a component of it that is heavily based in tort law, but there's, it touches upon, you know, right to privacy, you know, in the Constitution, Fourth Amendment law. So I think that's one of the difficulties, that there are so many other legal elements of privacy, mm-hmm. whereas I get the sense, and you would probably have a better idea, but I feel like copyright's more straightforward in that sense. And then another point I was thinking of is I feel like one of the problems we face, it would be great if we could establish something like Creative Commons, but, you know, having privacy licenses, but I feel like one of the problems that we run into is that you have to make a distinction between whether it's going to come from users or from the websites, because, you know, one way of looking at it is having all the users be like, okay, well, this is my personal privacy license. I change it depending on what website I'm giving information to.
Yeah.
And like, I'm assigning these licenses to these different websites. Or you can look at it from the perspective of, well, I'm this website, and here's the privacy license that we are going to use for all content that you submit to our site. And I think one of the biggest issues in implementing something like this would be to decide from which direction you want to come when approaching, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. In the copyright context, what you'll see a lot of times in terms of ServiceNow is the site will take this big, broad license from the user for whatever they upload, right? But then they'll say, but you can apply a license vis-a-vis the rest of the world, a Creative Commons license. We get to choose as a platform whether we're going to use our big, broad platform license, which lets us, you know, redistribute it, reformat it, et cetera, do a lot of things that's not in a Creative Commons license. But vis-a-vis all the rest of the users, the Creative Commons license applies. So if you look in like the blogger terms of service, I think it's still there when I had to write the blogger terms of service once. It says exactly that kind of thing. And I wonder if something similar can be done with privacy. I don't know, though. But I think that's exactly like a really interesting framework to look at it in terms of the platform versus your peers.
Yeah. And the other problem I feel is, you know, this phrase gets tossed around a lot in this debate, but the idea of informed consent, whether, you know, right now, whether you know when you're submitting your name and address and, you know, Twitter to a website, you know, whether you know what's going to be done with that information. I think another problem is transparency, that, you know, with use of information, there often isn't a lot of transparency. And, you know, as you pointed out, like the average user might not be as aware of a lot of these issues and the ways in which their information gets used.
Right. The average user or a congressman.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So following up a little bit on the question before on medical records, but more sort of generalizing, I would be really interested if you or someone else here comment on the kind of lack of uptake, I guess, on these precedents that you mentioned, that have these things, ideas not caught on because there hasn't been that groundswell that you're referring to, or are they not addressing the right problem, or are they just not usable enough? So, you know, what's prevented some people from catching on so far, given that there clearly have been some attempts?
Right. I don't know the answer for sure. I mean, I think part of it has to do with that privacy is much more of a mishmash of regulations across different jurisdictions and from different legal regimes. I think that's part of it. I mean, if we look at the Mozilla example, it's a really cool idea, but it's different. It's this, from what I gather from it, it's more about, this is aiming more at the transparency part than the choice part. It's more kind of showing you, the effort here is to show you what the website's policy is to the best it can versus the user coming to the website and saying, you can't deal with me unless you meet these rules. But I think the Mozilla idea, I think, is only like a year or two old, and I'm curious to see where it goes. I think it's really just like a plug-in right now, and I think it could possibly have legs. I just don't know enough about it. I don't remember kind of what the story was behind P3P's history and where it went. In terms of how it caught on or how it didn't catch on. So that might be an interesting place to look to see if there's any lessons there to be drawn. Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering about, so it seems like copyright pretty clearly attaches to one person or a clear group of people, but when it comes to privacy, I wonder sort of a photo with a group of people in it, you know, do you have to consult each individual person? Do we have to sort of like blur out the faces? If, you know, if I want to, you know, and I think this comes up with sort of tagging on Facebook or or and you know, I think the riots are a great example of that. I may be really proud of what I did, but the person who, next to me in the photo wakes up the next day and thinks, oh crap. You know, so how, I mean, are there ways of figuring out, and you know, would, that seems to me a difficulty in this room, thinking about them some.
Yeah, that definitely sounds right, especially when you consider just how many photographs are going up. And there's a really interesting dilemma that everyday people who are not journalists now face all the time, which is, you know, it used to be like only a journalist worries about, or like a professional biographer would worry about, are they invading someone's privacy by posting something about it? But it's like we all face that like every day now, right?
Like people will tell you, don't put this on Facebook, or it's okay to put this on Facebook. You know, you have to check, you feel like you have to check with people before you post.
Right.
Kind of going back to the issue of like conserving the non-geeks and whatnot, and the whole idea of transparency versus choice. I feel like just going from the point of transparency isn't going to be sufficient to really help the average user, because I mean, even just looking at the Mozilla example, I don't even remember how many. Yeah, there's quite a few different things they can tell you there, and when you access information at kind of the rate that we do now, and you're going between pages, you're not going to have someone sitting at the computer looking at like, okay, we're at this now, so I'm going to pull out my chart of what's going on, because it's just not effective for what we use the internet for.
Right.
And I feel like unless you put people through the active process of this is what I want to do, you're not going to get average users with a really good idea of what their privacy is online.
Totally. Yeah, I agree. And the other thing is that, you know, I think when it comes to privacy, a lot of times, well, this is true for almost anything online, how many people would really kind of stop and go, yeah, I don't think I'm going to use this website now. In terms of like the bargaining power between the user and the platform, it's kind of like, the only exception is kind of when you will get the notice. This is just purely anecdotal. It'd be really interesting if someone did a study on this from like a user experience point of view. Is when you get the interstitial that says, this is not a trusted site. Are you sure you want to proceed? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That seems to actually catch people's attention, and people be like, oh yeah, I'm not in the office. I probably shouldn't, you know, I probably shouldn't go forward with the site. Or this isn't an unsecure wireless network. That catches people's attention, right?
Yeah. I think maybe the idea behind that is that when you see something like this, you're not necessarily thinking risk. You're thinking, yeah, different version of something involving my privacy that probably isn't going to affect me, but as soon as something says this site isn't trusted or this site is like risky, then you're like, okay, this might affect me. So yeah, I could see something like that where you kind of alert users not just to the level of transparency but also to the implications, which is kind of what that's doing. I feel like if transparency is going to have any success among average users, it's going to have to come from that perspective where it is an awareness of not just what the transparency is, but how that plays out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you mentioned Hyperpublic itself a little bit ago, and I think going back to that, there might be kind of not a solution, but like kind of a start to this or a response, which is that one thing that people talked a lot about in Hyperpublic when they were talking about, you know, how we're going to behave in this Hyperpublic arena or area or whatever is the importance of social norms that are going to play this role of kind of protecting people. Or, you know, Dana Boyd, I think it was, gave this example that youth will hide behind their language, and that will be a barrier for privacy because certain people won't understand what they're implying in their posting or whatever. And so I think that maybe, you know, it might be really hard for a top-down kind of institution to implement this privacy thing for all the reasons that you were talking about, but if it started, it would have to start from like a user perspective. It just, this is a norm that we're going to do. You know, you were talking a little bit about how you don't post a picture on Facebook necessarily without asking your friends if it's okay. Well, that's a norm. That's a social norm that's kind of been developing and that we're using now and we're beginning to implement on a wider scale because we recognize it as something that's socially important. And, you know, maybe eventually it'll become widely spread enough to start actually giving us privacy where we might not have had it before. But that if you're going to start imposing this, you know, there's so many different ways that privacy can be violated and also different ways that people want it to be protected, that I think it would be very hard for, you know, the government or some other policy maker to really suggest something that's going to work.
Can you talk a little more about the point that you made about essentially people speaking more or less in code as a way of maintaining their privacy? It's like, you know, there's like Cold War Samizdat kind of like precedence to that, which is like a really rich subject.
Well, I think if I remember correctly, the example that was given during the conference was a girl posted something on her Facebook saying, like, oh my God, she's such a bitch, is I think what she said. And, excuse my language, and all of her friends, she got a million, like, 50 of her friends liked the comment on Facebook and was like, I totally get that. But her parents saw that and were like, what are you talking about? But the kids who understood what she was referring to in that comment were able to be on the in and, you know, they were able to understand. And so in a way, she was hiding behind that comment from her parents or from her teachers or for people who she didn't want to understand what she was saying so clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
But communicating at the same time with her peer group or the people she intended to share with. I mean, I think you see examples of that beyond only bad language on a kid's Facebook site. So, inside jokes or, there's ways of keeping people out while still being public that I think people are beginning to develop and understand how to use. You see it with maybe emoticons or, you know, LOL or other acronyms that people use a lot. Could be beginnings.
That's really interesting. And there's a bunch of, just historical kind of scholarship about code switching as, like, you know, sort of different languages between subcultures and that sort of thing. Totally different contexts, right, in terms of different ethnic groups. That's a really interesting angle. Yeah.
Well, I just thought that was kind of interesting because Facebook does have privacy controls. I mean, it wouldn't have been that difficult for that person just to set the status so only certain people could see it or, you know, prevent her parents from seeing it and let everyone else see it. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I don't know. Part of the problem is that the codes are it's a kind of hidden in terms of controlling access, and I think Facebook kind of pushes you to make everything public, so maybe part of the problem, but I don't know, it just also seemed kind of strange that people sort of use that approach as opposed to just, you know, doing a technical measure.
Well, the technical measure may not be fine-grained enough, I guess, is maybe part of the issue, or maybe there's just, it's another way of attacking it, right, I guess.
Yeah.
You have a follow-up?
Yeah, I was just going to respond to that. I think we mentioned it a little bit with what one of the issues might be with a code this complicated is the privacy settings on Facebook just aren't that accessible for people who aren't really willing to invest the time in using them. And, you know, I consider myself someone who knows how to use them if I wanted to and cares enough about this, but I still don't go and change them every time Facebook updates them, you know, because there's a level of inaccessibility to it and it takes a lot of time and it's really nuanced and stuff like that. And so I think it can be off-putting. And that might be why for that one status that you're just not going to change it.
Well, I wanted to address specifically this code in reference to policy changes within sites people are already using. Because I know I've seen personally within like peer groups that I'm in multiple like policy change scares, like places where policies weren't actually changed, but you got 6 emails from people saying, Facebook has done this, go check your settings. And I think one of the ways, you know, obviously I agree with what Matt's saying to a certain extent. People aren't going to be paying a lot of attention to a really complex code if they're, you know, surfing the internet. But if Facebook or and a photo uploader or anyone changes, makes a concrete policy change, I could see a real utility to having a page that pops up somewhere to the this site is not trusted that says this changed from this, which it was yesterday, to this. Are you sure you want to continue? As like a method of encouraging people to be aware of what's different, you know, maybe not saying like when you first sign up, these are, you know, having that for every site, but providing a method whereby people can actually access those changes without like rooting through the terms of service.
Mm.
As a follow up to that, the Google dashboard is halfway to that, I think, already.
Well, tell us more about it. I don't work there anymore, so I don't know how it works.
Google dashboard tries to put on one page all of the various links and privacy preferences associated with Google and identities you've associated with your Google account.
Mm.
So it would be a short step from that to also having the icon or the change.
I know people have also tossed around the idea of like having like a Firefox add-on or something that like updates every time Facebook changes something or like, but it would be like a third-party kind of thing. It wouldn't be like a site-related thing.
Have you got a chance to talk?
I think there may be a practicality that businesses, once you cross over into commerce, are very aware of the practicality concern. The amount of time that the average person is going to devote to social media when they have many other things that they need to attend to as time goes on, and this is part of the age gap in terms of social media use, is not going to be that great, particularly not to one particular site and one set of codes. And commercially, businesses looking for a digital business model, which very few have right now, it's an interesting problem, are really going to try to, I think, push against more restrictions and more rules, simply because they know as a matter of practicality, you're not going to go to a site and spend time with it if you have to relearn the lexicon every time you go there. So it's an interesting discussion, but I think there's a force, and it's mainly a commercial force, pushing against that idea.
Yep, in the back there.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about, I mean, I really like the examples Dana Boyd gave, but I think digitalization in many cases means that we have less opportunity to develop social norms. Something that comes to mind for me is that when medical records are digitized, they become much more accessible to the practitioners, which means that the patient has less choice of what to tell the doctor. And in Germany, that has come up with the introduction of electronic health card, which gives access to digital health records, and you can block certain, so you have kind of privacy options there in the sense that you can block certain information for certain doctors. But few people will do that just because of the trust relationship they have. Even if they want to, they will feel pressured to make this information available to the doctor, because the doctor can say, okay, you're not telling me. What are you hiding there? And the doctor would not be able to see that if it were not digitized.
Sorry, yeah. Oh, you haven't got a chance to talk, right? Go ahead.
I was just wondering, I think the worthwhile comment is that people don't know to be afraid until they feel threatened, and so the fact is, especially I think among young people, it's not until a picture of you in a bikini is on a teen porn site that you begin to really think about the consequences of producing that kind of material. And I wish there were a way that alerts or something that if media is utilized elsewhere on the internet, I think that if there were somehow a way that everything had to be tagged, because I mean a lot of people try on Tumblr and Blogger and when they're using other images to be respectful of people's privacy, but I think that especially when it comes to pornography, especially when it comes to using imagery that may or may not be legal of people who are underage and things, you take advantage of naivete and trustworthiness. And I don't know if it's enough to sort of go into schools and be like, hey, it's not that smart to text pictures of yourself naked to your friends, because people continue doing it and people are rebellious. And I don't know. I think like somehow imposing both a preliminary and a before something horrible happens and also a sort of inconsequence responsive.
Yeah.
I just want to ask about how many claims you have on Twitter, because I know Courtney Love, she's been sued a few times, right? And is it a common occurrence? Is she the only one? And also about the whole privacy thing that's going on in England, and that's kind of drawn you into it, right? And you've gotten some disclosure orders. Kind of the, if you could just talk about the privacy in England and the problem, you know, they're trying to develop the privacy law there.
Right.
They're issuing injunctions. And do we have anything similar?
Well, so I don't know the answer to the first question about how many libel suits there have been. In general, I'm not technically a lawyer for Twitter. I work in business development, so I'm not really able to comment on all that stuff. So it's probably best just for me to steer clear of that. We have a lot of statements we've made around that kind of stuff. I just can't really get into here. So yeah.
But the privacy. Our privacy law. Not to the extent that you can in other jurisdictions, but you know, if somebody posts a picture of you that you don't like and you don't want up there, do we have any?
I mean, there are generally four torts. I think, see if I can remember them. This is going to be like, has this high pressure? So there's false light, invasion of privacy, which is something, the publication of something that makes it, that that's a little bit of a context issue. It's a publication of some facts about you or an image of you that seems to put you in a false light. Those are not the same in every state, and definitely not the same in every country. There's kind of invasion privacy torts that are basically like the telephoto lens taken over a fence kind of invasion tort. Publication of private facts, and then I go fuzzy on it. I'm afraid I get a D on that test. I took that class from Charles Nesson too, and Zittrain. I should remember that. but there's a bunch of different kind of somewhat black, somewhat gray laws around it. But they are different in every state.
Yeah, so. Do you think it would help to unify
them? Probably, but there is not. I don't know if anyone's been successful. Privacy is such like a big. It can describe like 18 different kind of anxieties we have about different things, right? And I feel like I don't think there's a. Maybe the difficulty is that we're looking for a unified theory of privacy and there's not one. I don't know. Maybe that's the answer, or maybe we'll get there, and we just don't know what it is yet. Should I transition to the next topic? Just in the interest of time, because it's 1:15, and we'll get going with the next one. It's actually related to this one in more closely than you might think. And here's kind of this is the segue slide. This is the transition slide. So in this kind of context, talking about what can government confidentiality and the security state and all that. What can they learn from, say, YouTube in the area of content regulation or content control? So this is where we get into bots, mobs, and geeks. So here's my three kind of depictions of the bot, the mob, and the geek. That's Lewis from Revenge of the Nerds, in case you don't know. So a lot of this is, a lot of these, what I'm going to go through, they're kind of old stories, almost like archetypal, collective unconscious kind of like Jungian kind of anxieties slash hopes that are, I think, really coming to a head right now in a bunch of different ways. Some of them, I say both anxiety and hope, because I think there's visions of rule by automation or rule by bot. There's visions of rule by the mob, and there's visions of rule by experts or rule by geeks that are both positive and negative. They're kind of utopian and dystopian. And so a lot of these are really familiar. They're very old stories. So kind of rule by bot, there's lots of dystopian examples of this one, right? And I would say ranging from kind of Frankenstein to, HAL in 2001. The Terminator, obviously, that's the whole premise of the whole thing. We actually ended up being ruled by the Terminator in California. And then in a different way, Lessig's original insight about code being law, and that was a fairly pessimistic book, if you recall. And I think that is kind of, let's just stretch the analogy to say that code is law is kind of another way of saying rule by automation or rule by bot. There's also the kind of utopian vision of it. This was just, very recently, Time Magazine, just so in the mainstream, the singularity, if you would ever guess it, the singularity would be on the cover of Time Magazine, and that humans will live forever because of machines. Pretty striking kind of fact about this being around now. Rule by mob, the traditional, obviously I'm using the word mob, it's automatically a loaded term. The traditional kind of fear of rule by mob is a little bit like what you saw on the New York Times Magazine cover just, I guess, 2-3 weeks ago of a mob in South Africa, exercising vigilante justice in a really disturbing, extremely disturbing example. That's the classic kind of vision of rule by mob. But in the last 10 years or so, we've obviously seen a more optimistic version of kind of a vision of rule by mob with smart mobs or wisdom of crowds, or what's possible when people are able to come together in a decentralized way. And, the pinnacle of this is like the Arab Spring, though not everyone. If you recall, when the stuff in Tahrir Square was happening, there were some people there were both sides of it. There was anxiety and there was hope about it. Some people were worried it's going to go the way of the Iranian Revolution in the end, once all this kind of goes, or some people think this is the groundswell that's going to change everything. So there's both kind of approaches. And then, rule by geek is another less maybe discreet example, but if you think about it, there's lots of kind of geek villains in kind of culture. That's Nelson from Seinfeld, but that's his role in Jurassic Park when he plays kind of the evil IT guy, right? Who everything, he can control everything from his post in the IT department and foils everybody's plans. Dr. Strangelove, I think, is the classic kind of evil geek Basically someone who is an expert whose authority, it's not clear where their authority comes from, other than that they have some skill or access to some kind of information that no one else has. There's obviously lots of examples these days of the geek as hero. You know, we want to be ruled by some geeks. There's this desire to, you know, to hand over the reins to someone who's so expert in something that we want to follow them. And then there's a lot of examples where people are kind of not quite sure how to feel about it, like how people feel about the Supreme Court or the legal profession in general as some, you'll see this kind of both hope and anxiety about the judiciary in general, right? How much authority are we giving them over our lives? The Federal Reserve is another one that comes up a lot. And then on a more personal level, kind of how technocracy can affect our daily lives in terms of just how much you rely on your doctor and how much you rely on, you know, something like a financial advisor or something like that, and where you were, there's total information asymmetry between you and that person. And so these are big just kind of memes out there, and people have written a lot about all of these, right? And I just want to kind of pull the three together and talk about how they interact. I mean, if you take the example of the doctor, you see things like the crowd playing off of the fear of technocracy by having websites where you can rate your doctors, right? So I want to talk a lot about the interaction here. And the example that first made me think about this was this article in the New York Times a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, that talked about the military having so much video footage from their drones that they had no idea what to do with it. Which was really interesting. They talk about, you know, it would take 24 years to watch it all. And I was working at, you know, YouTube at the time, and I was like, that sounds awfully familiar. And then lo and behold, as you get into the article, they talk about basically different methods that the military had tried to use to make sense of all this glut of footage. Can you guys read that? Oh, that's a little bit better than the Mozilla icons in terms of size. So if you kind of think about the things that are circled here, you know, the military looked at just hiring tons and tons of analysts. They couldn't really crowdsource it because it's all kind of confidential stuff, right? You don't. Although you could maybe do some sort of moon clickers thing where you decontextualize it so much that it could work. They were looking at automation, and then this kind of punchline in it is that, you know, you need someone who's trained and accountable. So this is kind of the mob, the bot, and the geek, and the military is trying to figure out what's the way to tackle that. This is a headline that I just loved that I thought summarized it a lot from Slate. This was from this year, from around the time of the stuff going on in Libya. And so all this reminded me of Content ID and YouTube, and I think it's a broadly misunderstood thing, and I can say this now because it doesn't sound like I'm shilling because I don't work there anymore. But basically the interaction between the mob or crowdsourcing robots and then geeks or experts. The right around the time that Google bought YouTube, Mark Cuban here, pre-NBA championship, he had this riff that he would go on in his blog that was about let me pose this question to you, public. If YouTube can't control what goes up on the site in terms of copyrighted material, how come you don't find any porn on the site? And that was his big question, and it completely kind of ignored a basic fact of copyright, which is everything's copyrighted, and the question is whether or not it's authorized. And there's no way of actually looking at something, a video, and knowing whether it's authorized. You can't actually crowdsource whether something is copyright infringing or not. You would get, people have tried it. You would get both, false positives and false negatives. Especially given that you've got major media companies who were, uploading things to YouTube, like the marketing arm wouldn't tell the legal department. We'd often get calls in the same week from, you know, the same company where a video would go up and then it would come down, and then the marketing would call back from the same company and say, "What happened to the video we put up?" And especially when you think about, you know, nowadays, lots of different companies essentially claiming and monetizing user videos that have their copyrighted material in them. So they'll actually go into the system and say, actually, we own the music in that video. You've probably seen it happen with a YouTube video that you uploaded that had commercial music in it, and then an ad appears, and that money goes to the record label, right? Even though it's your vacation video. So it's an interesting thing. So in terms of how it actually breaks down, the difference between porn and copyright on YouTube, just to go into it and I think help provide a framework for the bot, mob, geek kind of metaphor. On the copyright side, the first kind of line of defense is this content ID system that basically scans every upload to the site, like something like 30 hours of video a minute now, that gets compared against a database that's full of reference files from copyright holders. That actually, interestingly enough, I have reference files and rules there. These days, something like 90% of the reference files are set to monetize instead of block, which is interesting in terms of the kind of change of the embrace of user-generated content. But then, so a rule is applied, and let's say it's blocked. So this may have happened to you at some point on YouTube. You upload a video, you get a message that says, before it even goes live, it'll say, sorry, we think that there may be some material that belongs to XYZ Music Group or XYZ Movie Studio. That doesn't cause a DMCA takedown. So this is a kind of a key point that actually just blocks the video and then gives the user a chance to review and then kind of appeal if they want to. And I put appeal in quotation marks because it's not really a legal action. It's just simply looking at the video and putting it live again. Once the video goes live, then the copyright owner's recourse is to actually do an actual legal takedown under the DMCA. And then if it goes any farther, if the user doesn't dispute it, or if the user does dispute it, then it could end up in court, and it's up for the judge. On the kind of pornography side, you could also put ultraviolet videos in this category, or anything that is not technically a legal issue, but it's a YouTube policy issue in terms of stuff they wanted to keep off the site. The first line of defense is crowdsourcing. So it's this flag is inappropriate. And it's really kind of mind-blowing that this works, that there's so many eyeballs in such a short period of time on things getting uploaded to the site that videos that are inappropriate get flagged, that you see a spike in terms of flags, that sends the videos then to literally a team room full of people who look at thumbnails of the videos and apply the policies. They have a big handbook in terms of what is kind of racy, what is over the line, what is appropriate only for mature audiences, et cetera. And there's a takedown. So in terms of using the bot mob geek kind of analogy here, these are the roles that the different kind of powers play. Robots are not yet very good at recognizing porn or ultraviolet material. There's some software out there that's starting to get there. And mobs are not good at recognizing things that have to do with copyright. It's really only something that the copyright holder or a judge, who's kind of the geek in this scenario, can decide. And similarly, the content squad, the people who are expert in the internal rules, are the kind of geeks in this area. But so one kind of principle that we would talk about at YouTube when we were designing this was the robots cannot make decisions that have the force of law. They may be able to block a video when it's getting uploaded, but that's not going to be an official DMCA takedown. That's not going to count as a copyright strike against the user. Because if you get a certain amount of strikes, then your account gets deleted. Because we don't know, we don't want to give a robot authority that has the kind of authority that only should come from the law, right? And then there should be some sort of human oversight. And so that's just kind of where I kind of started in thinking about this and how we can apply this kind of model or this way of thinking about these three different things interacting to a bunch of different contexts. And a friend of mine who teaches law at NYU Law School, Sam Raskoff, who's a constitutional lawyer, had this kind of analogy for, is there a sort of separation of powers that we can come up with? Sort of a combination of the, Asimov laws of robotics applied to the bots, mobs, and geeks. And then what happens if we apply it to different scenarios? Like, think about the financial crisis of 2008. This was on the cover of Wired and around then, the formula that wrecked Wall Street, right? Think of this as kind of the bot gone wild. This was essentially a technology, right, that was, its flaw was that it was not aware of other formulas like this and that there was no kind of SEC geek oversight over this particular process. An example that's straight out of the Berkman Center is Herdict. If you think about, say, a dictator as a kind of a geek, like where does their authority come from exactly? That they decide to shut down the internet in a particular place or decide to filter certain websites from a certain place. The way to kind of route around that is to crowdsource. That's essentially the model there. And then you can get, I warned you at the beginning there were free associations but that were going to happen. But you can, I think, even take it into other totally different contexts. If you think about open source versus proprietary software, there's a pretty obvious kind of metaphor there. Open source is essentially a mob-powered bot. Like that open source is a big robot that's being controlled by a widely distributed group of people versus proprietary software, which may be kind of top-down, a geek imposing a particular bot on the populace. And, you know, there have been analogies before between the Reformation and open source and free software, which made me think of, so the Pope as geek. So, and this could apply a bunch of different religions. I'm Catholic, so I can talk about the Pope. Sort of the idea of there being, you know, could this bot mob geek rule apply in the realm of spirituality? I was just trying to like push, see how many places you could apply it. And if you think about, yeah, I mean, in a way, a high priest is a geek. That's, you know, the Federal Reserve or the high priest of finance, the Supreme Court or the high priest of law. And then just kind of as a comical note, the Vatican did release an iPhone app this year, which I don't know if you guys saw it. It's pretty amazing. You can it actually takes you through and asks you questions, and then it helps you decide whether or not you need to confess. and then maybe, I'm sort of imagining that sometime it'll take like micropayments and it'll be like straight back to the Middle Ages and you pay for absolution. So anyway, I just kind of want to open it up and think about, it is obviously a totally way broad subject, but I want to think about, is it useful as a framework for talking about any number of things? And that's kind of it. Yeah, Joseph.
It'd be interesting to come up with a specification and understanding of what does it mean to have power. And then you could look at each one of those actors with respect to the types of characters and features of characters. So one of the things that's so intriguing about bots is they can act so quickly. So there's like a speed feature characteristic. There's also a characteristic of, can they act beforehand or is it a punishment afterhand? So you could come up with all these dimensions. And I know in the content filtering space, I think the W3C and perhaps others ended up specifying guidelines so that, for instance, if a bot blocked access to a particular website, the user would be informed of the fact, so it wouldn't happen sort of automatically. So that's one of the, you know, so a community has identified that's one of the dangers of bot power is that it can be so pervasive it can become almost hidden. So it's kind of interesting to think about people who have tried to articulate ethics or rules around each one of these power dynamics in the context of the dimensions of the power of each.
Right. And similarly, in the content recognition area, I mean, I don't know if people talk about this still, but a few years ago, there was this discussion between the distinction between digital rights management and digital rights detection, whereas the former was actually going to prevent action, and the latter would simply record the fact that something was happening with that content. And there's similar analogies in like national security in terms of, this is a big stretch, but certain regimes will not repress speech via media or social media or technology, but instead actually use it as a tool of surveillance, right? I mean, there's a sort of an analogy there. I think that's a...
Another space, actually, is bots on Wikipedia. Stuart Geiger has written some really great work around bots and how much power and what ways they're used. So, for example, there's all kind of content filtering bots that, like, immediately get rid of curse words. There's all the sort of bots that flame things that require human intervention. So, again, you see all these sort of gradations of interaction between these players.
Yeah.
I think this relates nicely to what we were talking about before with the privacy part of this talk. I mean, I think... We were saying that how are you going to have one person setting the privacy for everyone? Are you going to rely on these social norms that emerge from the users? Or are you going to have some sort of automatic setup thing that's going to happen on any given website? And I think what this shows is that not, you know, any one of those answers in and of itself is it probably going to be sufficient. And that ultimately some sort of privacy is going to rely on an interaction between the automatic and the geek, or the geek and the mob, and, you know, the social norms that come out of them, and that it'll be some combination of the three that ultimately has a workable model,
right,
for privacy.
Right. That's an interesting idea. I see what you mean, how they're connected that way. In terms of, it goes back to our point about how do you establish the standard, right, from the ground up or from the top down. So yeah, you got to say something.
So just to kind of follow up on that, I think one of the things that I was thinking of during the privacy conversation is that we were all very rooted in sort of the now and the transactional kind of immediate form that social media often takes. But there's obviously a tail to it, too, where once that data is published, it's available and there are places where it's stored and preserved. And so in many ways, copyright, kind of in copyright law, we get some view of the long term by the expiration provisions and things like that. And as we transfer to the idea of who should be the decision maker or who should hold the power around those decisions, it strikes me that as we think about the immediate, you have to leverage automation, you have to leverage crowdsourcing to be able to make a decision in the now about what's appropriate or what's permissible. But as you think about what might or might not be preserved in the long tail, that's when it makes sense that maybe a geek might need to come in, and much in the same way that for YouTube, a human would always have to intervene about something that would actually go on record for that particular user, in much the same way as we look at sort of the historic preservation of data, that might take a different, there may be a different threshold there in terms of what we'll allow or not allow when we think about, holding data for all posterity or something like that.
That's interesting. And then, so basically saying, we need to rely on the crowd and we need to rely on automation because there's just too much happening right now to try and do it all kind of with single people. I know that there's a counterpoint to that, which is that I know the YouTube content ID system was criticized at times for the theory would be if someone was abusing a copyright or if they put a file into the system that they didn't own, and they were using copyright as a pretext for censoring,
yeah,
then that's a potential danger there.
Yeah.
And then I think the way to fight back against that is to basically make the penalties for someone doing that big enough to where you would deter them from doing so. But it's a really tough one. If the window during which that review process happens is too long and it's breaking news, then it's an interesting dilemma.
YouTube, it seems in the relationship between these three, the geek in the YouTube examples, in the position of final say on both after the robot and the crowd, and really in terms of the reason the robot and the crowd are there are to save resources of the geek is the geeks are limited resources. Questions are there examples where this relationship is turned around? And you kind of hinted at it with Herdic that maybe that's one way of thinking of Herdic is that it's the crowd, the mob checking on the geek, the dictator who's filtering. But are there other perhaps more compelling examples where this relationship is reversed between the geek and the bot or the geek and the mob?
Right. Where the final decision maker is, say the mob or the bot. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, let's
Google algorithm. Google always says we hands off. We don't mess with the algorithm if you're not on the top page. So I can make they give privilege to the bot.
But the algorithm itself is a function of the crowd, right? In terms of the backlinking. But it is the ultimate decision maker. Yeah, that's interesting.
All of
it.
There's that.
What's that?
All aggregators, not just Google. All kinds of social media aggregators grew up like that. I think that's what Sharpie means when he says the filter that publishes is turned on to a publish then filter mechanism. And he refers to news. That there, the mob is
there. Right,
although it's sort of as the three powers, because you look at something like eBay's rating system, they changed it a couple years ago, so no longer did sellers get to rate buyers, and that means that the geeks get to control ultimately. I mean, you can say that the algorithm depends on the mob, but the algorithm's created by the geeks, and the geeks control what the mob gets to rate. So it's an interdependence between the powers.
Right. So I didn't know about the change in policy. So it used to be that buyers and sellers could rate each other. Yeah.
And then for whatever reason, they decided that sellers could no longer rate buyers, which created quite a scream. And to a great extent, eBay changed around then from an auction site to a sales site. And maybe they're related, maybe they're not.
Mm.
But, it radically sort of changed the information available.
Interesting. I've bought things on eBay, but I've never sold any things on eBay. What would the seller rate the buyer on?
Whether they paid.
Okay. I would think that would be the first.
The other one is
the threshold.
It's fairly one thing that's fairly easy as a buyer on eBay is if you're unhappy to get your money back. PayPal tends to be fairly generous in terms of the way it resolves dispute. So there's the I never received it, I want my money back, and then, you know, unless the seller was selling it, sending it in a way where there was guaranteed delivery, which doesn't make sense for very low dollar items, the seller was out.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the sellers, it's the same thing as, you know, stores tend to notice who they think is shoplifting and start to, or somebody returns items too many times.
Uh-huh.
You know, oh, the prom's over and we got the dress back for the third year in a row, and then people start getting persona non grata. I mean, that kind of rating of consumers has always gone on in retail, and that was sort of available up until a couple of years. The way my mind works is probably 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, time flies, but it radically changed sort of the information that was available from the mob, and it was controlled by geeks.
Mm.
So in any of these systems where the mob, perhaps, as Joseph suggests, is providing the information, ultimately there's a geek somewhere deciding what that information is and, you know, how many choices you get. I mean, you know, does Netflix give you 5 choices for movies or 3? I always find that there's the one in between that I want that I can't get. You know, really liked it, hated it. Well, you know, there's something in between, like, well, it was okay. So, you know, there's assignments of powers.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and kind of going back to the point of mobs rating geeks who are deciding the rating system for the geeks, I think you can sometimes also, depending on kind of what context you're working with, get out of that. If you have, I guess, like a third party geek, what comes to mind, like kind of immediately when you brought up, for example, the rating your doctors, I immediately thought of, I don't know how many people have heard rateyourprofessor.com, where basically students go online and they rate different aspects of professors, how hard was the class, how interesting was it, what did you get out of it, and ostensibly. Yes, Ben, you can give them a chili pepper if they're hot. but that aside, I mean, ostensibly, you're not having all of your professors go online and decide this is what our students can rate us on. I mean, maybe there's one professor doing all of it, but I feel like that's kind of a situation where you really do have kind of a mob rating the geeks for the power holders in that case. In a way that it doesn't, at least on face value, there doesn't seem to be a reason for whoever's creating the system to have an incentive to tilt either way. So I think it is possible, it just depends on who's designing the structure.
That's an interesting example. I was thinking of, I don't know why I would make this association between call centers and classes, but I was thinking if there's some sort of way to kind of crowdsource around the frustration you have when you're trying to call an airline or call your bank and you're just punching numbers for like 30 minutes and you can't get through to anyone who can make a decision. I don't know. And most people kind of will take to social networks and just complain about it until they get like a refund.
And sometimes people post direct, like if they get a direct number, you know, like if you're a special person, then they'll go and post it online. Somebody suggested recently that somebody should buy the upper level domain .sucks and then just make sites for all
of us. Well, actually, do you know what? Twitter was saved the day just before Christmas. I was in London and there was a big snowstorm and all the flights were canceled. And if you called British Airways, nothing. You emailed them, nothing. And the word got around, all the taxi drivers were telling everyone the best way to contact British Airways on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And that's how you found that your flight was taken off. But
wow.
Twitter has done so much. In England, because I know you've heard I want to talk about it, but, you know, can I just say that was it, what was in the press about it?
Sure, I am.
Right? What's happening in England is they're trying to develop the privacy law because of Article 8 of the European Convention of Human Rights. So, they don't want the British tabloids writing about the personal lives of celebrities. So, they go to an English judge and say, I don't want my sex life all over the news. The world, all of us, so they get a court order, an injunction. And the British press were so annoyed by these injunctions that they were kind of like leaving hints, and a group of people went on Twitter and named the names of these people, which is, in England, that's quite serious because they're breaking this English court order, an injunction. But that is a really good example of what we're talking about now, because Twitter is basically breaking the power of an English judge, which of course they don't like. but it's also helping democracy, even in England, because the MP stood up in Parliament and named these people. And this MP who said, he goes, well, it's all over Twitter, so I'm going to say it here. But now Twitter has a disclosure order. Right. English judge.
I'm going no comment on this.
Yeah,
one.
No comment. Yeah. Anyway, but the point is, you know, it's not just the Arab Spring.
Right.
That, you know, Twitter is, you know, giving the, you know, the crowd is getting power through Twitter and Facebook, like you're saying, on social media, unlike ever before. And to break, you know, the order of an English judge is no, and anyway, I think you should fight it. Back to the order.
So we're at 1:45. I know that's kind of the outer limit, right? For
do you have a last question you were gonna ask?
Oh, sorry.
You wanna make a last point?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I was just gonna say. I mean, this is a huge jumping off point, but I think it would be interesting to consider how hacking fits in with all of this, because like hacking can influence bots and mobs and geeks, and then you have to question which one has the most integrity in a system, but that's like a whole nother conversation.
I think it's a really, really interesting place to end it. Like I think that there's a lot of discussion on that point, I think, in this model.
Well, please join me in thanking Glenn for a totally fabulous.